Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. American painter, printmaker, and sculptor Oliver Lee Jackson, born 1935, has created a complex body of work that masterfully weaves together visual influences ranging from the Renaissance to modernism, with principles of rhythm and improvisation drawn from his study of African cultures and American jazz. On view from April 14th through September 15th, 2019, at the National Gallery of Art, the exhibition Oliver Lee Jackson, Recent Paintings, presents 18 paintings created over the past 15 years, many of which are being shown publicly for the first time. Jackson's often large-scale paintings blend figural elements of bodies pointing, kneeling, drawing, and playing instruments with colorful abstract compositions and vigorously worked surfaces. To celebrate the exhibition opening, the gallery hosted Evenings at the Edge performances by the Marty Ehrlich Ensemble and Trio 3, featuring Oliver Lake, Reggie Workman, and Andrew Cyril, collaborators of Jackson and the influential Black Artist Group. On April 12, 2019, A.B. Spellman, distinguished poet, music critic, and arts administrator, moderated a post-concert discussion with renowned jazz musicians Ehrlich and Lake, along with Jackson and senior curator Harry Cooper. The conversation explored the relationships between music and the visual arts, ranging from shared experiences in St. Louis in the 1960s to the present day.
The topic today is really a debriefing, maybe, after everything we've seen and heard, but also thinking about, talking about artistic collaboration, because right here we've got artists, all of them, who have been involved with visual art, music, writing, poetry. And it goes way back to the shared experience with the three in the middle in St. Louis, coming up in the early 1960s, if not before. Got a couple generations here. We won't go into the specifics, but they all shared that. So that'll be one thing to talk about. But I'm going to turn it over to AB, who has thought a lot about these issues.
Right. Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. It's a lot easier when there are people in the room than where you know somebody is listening, and we have to think of intelligent things to say. The topic is
talk in there.
Yeah. The topic is collaboration, and we're talking about jazz musicians and visual artists. Jazz itself is, and I'll throw this at you, Marty, since you're sitting next to me. Jazz itself is fundamental collaboration, is it not?
I think at its core, yes.
Yes. You have to have people who are ready to come in. Think of collective improvisation and what a difficult thing that must be to do. It is really very hard. And then you have, because you have to hold it together, you have to have a structure which sometimes is not visible to the rest of the audience, and you have to be attentive to what your partners are doing. So, with that, having made that point, let's go back and look at some of the collaborations that went into these artists' work and lives at the very foundation of their careers. There's a St. Louis joint, as Harry made out of, St. Louis joint between them. And it was around an organization called BAG, a slang term from the period. Everybody was in a bag, but they were in BAG. And BAG was a collective. There's a history of collectives in the music going all the way back to the great James Reese Europe, who I encourage you to look up. And in the 1960s, there was an October Revolution in Jazz organized by Bill Dixon and Archie Shepp. There was AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. And there was, in St. Louis, there was the Black Artist Group. Now, let's ask our painter, since he is the star of our show, You were an affiliate of VAG, were you not?
Yes.
And you did work there. You had a job, and what was that job?
I didn't have a job. I wasn't salaried, but I was very intimate with the group as an affiliate.
I thought you were an assistant director of the People's Arts Center.
I was, but that was a different organization entirely. That was sponsored by the city and the elites in the city for the poor, and we ran that for the students, you know, young people, very young people, to have some experience with the arts, you know. And we also hired artists, and a number of people who became involved in BAG were, of course, involved in that. Because it's a close, St. Louis is a close community. Mm-hmm. So we knew each other.
All right. Now, Oliver, you were at the very foundation of BAG, were you not?
Yes, I was. I had actually taken a trip to Chicago. But prior to that, the musicians in St. Louis used to have a jam session almost daily in Forest Park, right out front of the St. Louis Art Museum. And then I made a trip to Chicago and met the Art Ensemble of Chicago and the AECM and Richard Muhal Abrams, and they had started the AECM. And I liked the fact that they were formally organized themselves as a group. So when I got back to St. Louis, I called Julius and other players who used to get together daily and play.
Julius Hemphill.
And then said, why don't we form a section of the AECM in St. Louis? And Julius said, no, let's start our own group. And we started the Black Artist Group.
But unlike AECM, which was devoted entirely to music, by the way, AECM is still going on. It is still working. That's one of the rare things that have happened. But and they were very broad. They talked about music broadly. I mean, they had everybody from popular musicians, soul singers, all the way up through the most mainstream jazz musicians, all the way to the most creative avant-garde work that was going on in the period has been produced by AECM. But unlike AECM, BAG was collaborations across disciplines.
Right, artists, dancers, poets, musicians, drummers, theater. So we involved all the arts into what we were doing, and we were fortunate enough to get our own building and present ourselves on a monthly basis. And the collaborations that we did with Oliver Jackson and Julius Hemphill and numerous other players who were there, it was a time for us to really hone our skills in collaboration and as well as with the various disciplines that were involved.
Okay, why don't you take us through you and Oliver Lee? Take us through how I know they used to call you that when you were a kid.
No, they didn't. They called me Jackson.
Oh, Jackson. Okay. Yes, as in Solid Jackson.
Yeah. Well, whatever it was,
It would not. All right, let's talk about the specific production. Jean Genet's play, The Blacks, which I'm sure many of you know, have read or possibly seen, I don't think it's been done around here in a long, long time, was one of the early productions. How did that work? How did you guys go about putting it together?
That was a long time ago, so it's really different. I'm trying to give information that's correct and not just off the top of my head. So you can tell them about Malenke was one of the theater people, and he was also writing his own work.
It's a poet named Malenke Elliott.
Yes, Malenke Elliott. And he, of course, he went on to become a professor in the theater. Where was that? It's in Oregon.
Oregon, yeah.
Yeah.
And he wrote his, as part of BAG, he wrote the Black Theater Notebook.
That's right.
Which is one of the first sort of theoretical studies of how the
theater should be
according to the aesthetics of the Black Artist Group.
Exactly. So he was doing that. I would make the sets after understanding the concept, and I don't remember quite what it looked like, but the materials that we had would tend to be materials like plastic sheeting, clear, that you could buy commercially, cardboard that you could get free, and we had platforms that you could change the level of the theater setting, and of course paint, and it was before theater of poverty, you know, that whole style was there. It was because we didn't have money. So what was important for me, we knew what the demands were.
So povera was not a style. Povera was...
No, it was a necessity.
A necessity.
Right. But that's when the learning began, that you, because of the limitations, you had to be very, very clear of what the point was, how you could get to, so that the materials accented the point of the play. And you had to be beautiful, too. So that was the real learning process. What the musicians demanded and what they had to have. What positions that worked for everybody. You couldn't interfere with the theater people acting. The costumes, we had to get it together very reasonable. I mean, paint and paper and stuff like that. But it made for a very exciting learning period in which you had to consider what it is you had in terms of resources and focus what the point it had to be made that was uppermost. And so everything had to work. So you had to relearn. It wasn't like academia. It really was different. So the cross learning was exciting. So you couldn't be egotistically locked into your own discipline to the expense, that's the real point, of the point, which was the play for the community and the way you wanted to present it.
You got it.
We were actually doing the production of the Blacks at Forest Park Community College, and that put us in touch with a lot of actors and dancers. So when we formed the Black Artist Group, we used the core of people that were involved in the play that we were doing at that particular time.
And what was the musician's role in the production?
We were providing music, and some of us did acting as well.
Okay.
You didn't hear Oliver Lee Jackson say "back up." That shows some tension that is always part of collaboration, right? Just wanted to out you on that one.
Well, my role was back up too. It was about the piece, you know.
Yes. Okay, but in Bagg's productions, especially the original pieces that you put up, I understand that there was largely improvisation in the writing and the development of dancing, the staging, and the visual components, as well as the music. It was largely improvised productions.
Well, the music was improvised, but a lot of the theatrical productions were all written and planned out. And a lot of the music was composed as well to accommodate the performances.
Well, some of the people who've been writing about Bagg have been lying on you.
No.
Well, they make the assumption, though. There's an assumption made, and you say jazz, that improvisation is what is... It is fundamental, but not in the way people think. It's not off the top of your head. In Bagg, there was a lot of planning before there was a real planning, writing, and the improvisation would take place in the practice with the dancers and all. But always in the actual performance, there's room for that. It's always left, you know, in the writing of the piece for improvisation to happen. But it was formalized quite.
We heard that last night.
Yes. We really did a lot of work. It wasn't off the top of the head in the way people think of it.
You know? There was a lot of improvisation in the music, but there was also a lot of composition. But in terms of theater, there was a lot of writing and planning and all that for our productions.
Marty, how did you get involved with these musicians?
As the youngest person up here of the three of us. So very interesting, and I want to say... what I think is such an important part of when a group of people come together as a artistic, spiritual, political force like the Black Artist Group, that, I became aware of them when the group was already over. And actually, I went, when I was in ninth grade, to a weekend arts program called MECA, Metropolitan Educational Cultural Association, which was held in the building that the Black Artist Group worked in, and a number of the Black Artist Group members taught there. So I took a drama class when I was in ninth grade with Malenke Elliott, He says I was awful as an actor, but I would just listen to the music, and one day he handed me an Ornette Coleman record and said, take it, it's yours. And
Which record was that?
It was The Empty Foxhole.
But tough record.
The point is that the energy that Bag had created was fully there, and I performed a lot with poets, the multidisciplinary thing. I performed under the rubric, a group continued called the Human Arts Ensemble, particularly a saxophonist named Jim Marshall. Oliver's on a couple of the Human Arts Ensemble records. And I first met Oliver, we actually made a record together called Under the Sun. I was still in high school, it was a real thrill for me. Lester Bowie was on it, J.D. Parin. But by the time I sort of came on the scene, Oliver and Julius Hemphill, I'd already left St. Louis. I got to know Julius and Oliver and all the ACM players when I moved to New York 4 years later. Before I went there, I had this, because I like to give props to my teachers, an amazing education at the New England Conservatory with the brilliant George Russell and Jackie Byard and Gunther Schuller and them. And then when I moved to New York, literally I began to perform almost full time with the musicians from St. Louis and Chicago. And I always felt very fortunate that I had made these friendships and connections before getting to New York, because a little bit like we talked, New York cannot be the easiest place to start things. And so, we've stayed friends forever.
So even your formative years were spent with musicians who were opening the form, who were expanding the music, who were looking to other ways of making music, incorporating that into jazz.
Yeah, I like I said, one of the first live sax players I ever heard was this gentleman here. I feel very blessed for that. But for me, the new jazz reflected what was going on. It reflected the civil rights movement. It reflected the black arts movement, the protests against the Vietnam War. It was the music that gave expression to the tenor of the times. I worked backwards from there throughout the history. And it was the black artist group guys, Julius, Oliver, Malenke, Jackson for sure, always said, don't stop. It's not just about jazz. It's about African-American music in its totality. It's not just about African-American music. It's about, you got to know about everything. You got to read. You guys were always pushing, this is not about learning a couple tunes. This is about having a worldview. And I think that really permeated the St. Louis scene.
Now, Oliver Jackson, one of your first collaborations was with Julius Hemphill, was it not?
Yeah, I guess so. The reason I'm being hesitant, I'm really trying to remember. We did a lot of things, right? But if you say the first one,
I wouldn't say that.
You know what I mean? I'm trying to figure out what was the first one.
You had a very close relationship.
You were very close. Yeah. we did a lot of talking. And it was like you could call it theoretical talk. And it covered the concept called modality. In music, that's a term that applies to modulation in music, a particular mode, but the way we were speaking of it, it's like a reality. What does a reality require? A particular reality. So we were discussing the idea that there are many realities. And if you step into one, what does it require? What are the limitations? And if you can hew to them, the aesthetics fall out of that. So we were really trying to figure out how modality could give clarity to aesthetic choice and be original inside that mode, not having to draw outside of itself for reference. So it's like being on Mars, living inside Mars, not looking to Earth to understand Mars, finding fully what Mars requires. And so what he mentioned is we're exploring what Africanness is, not as the United States and white America sees it, but how do we see it? So we have to explore ourselves. We assume we're African-American people, and that's the thrust, but we have to explore ourselves. Just to, what does it really mean to bring forth that sensibility in a work? It's not in opposed to anything. It's like, what does that mean? So we have to find out. We got some clues, and the clues are ourselves. So we know we're on the right track. But the intimacy has to be known so that you can improvise with surety. So that means build on something. We're not just talking about blowing off steam, but the improvisation is coming from an extremely solid place. And so you have to get there. What is that place? You know, that kind of talk. So we were, Julius and I, Lake, the poets, they were all involved. The conversations were really, the word intellectuality is not good. It seems like a separation from the passion. It was passionate talk. It was serious, and they were practicing. We try it out. It wasn't conceptuality simply for exercising the brain. It was like, will this work? And then the critique of what it is you were talking about. See, it's like you examining at the same time, like, no, that's not it. It doesn't feel right. With this kind of conceptualization is fundamental in this respect. It has to show itself objectively, and it has to satisfy what it is you think you're reaching for. So it's critical. It's critical. It's fiercely critical. You have to be tight. When I say that, I mean it's not simply blowing off steam, but simply being passionate because you are passionate. You have to have focus. And that focus requires that you bring it to the tightest and the clearest just as much as you can. So again, when you improvise then from that base, the improvisation is solid as a rock. You know, that's from your standpoint. That's before you hit the audience. So that when you play before them, you have surety, you know.
All right, now you guys, you two have also have, actually, all three of you have been involved in collaborations with this artist. Well, tell me about the work you did together, Oliver.
Well, our work goes back many years when the Black Artist Group formed and was in motion. We haven't collaborated in recent years at all. Marty has had a collaboration more recent than I have with Oliver. But we go back 50 years when we were doing things together.
That's what's hard. But we remember when we did the African Continuum, we were collaborating then. We were with the sets and how everything should work. Then right. We were doing the theater things. So that's what's hard to remember, the specific. We were doing so much at that time. The most recent, and it wasn't one-on-one, it would be with him and Julius and myself sitting down together, working out what is needed, and we talked about the electrician from New York, too. He was a collaborator, a lot of humor. We had a gentleman that we all liked very much. He was a collaborator, and we mentioned that he was supposed to take care of what the sound and electrical appliances and all. He it never worked, right? His collaboration was magnificent because it never worked. So it never really got in the way, but if you said, okay, the theater, he said, well, we want the lights to come on and dim over there. So when that time would come, you give him a cue and he would do something, nothing.
He was doing film and we never got one film.
Not one film. Not one. But it was wonderful.
Can I add, speaking of film, and there's a book that I just wanted to mention, if you're interested in the Black Artist Group, called Bag, Point From Which Creation Begins, and that subtitle is a reference to an Oliver Lake album, came out in 2004 by Benjamin Looker. One thing mentioned in the book is a film about the St. Louis Zoo that Oliver Lake was involved with.
Yeah, it meant that my quartet went in the studio and performed improvisation improvisational music to the film. Well, there was no written music. We just watched the film and played as it went along. And that was the basis of my score, my first visual score.
How about your collaboration with him?
I'm going to say a few things here that I hope, okay, might get a little emotional. But I don't know when Oliver and I started talking, but I know that at some point it felt like we had been talking forever. And we got very close in the late 70s. And at one point Oliver said, you know, Marty, and I should explain, I don't relate. I started as a poet. I'm very, poetry and music and writing are my thing. I don't relate to the visual arts the way many people do, but something about Oliver's painting has always been very visceral, very immediate to me. It made total sense in everything I understood about the music I loved. And, you know, surely I'll leave it at that. And we began to talk all the time. And at one point you said to me, hey, man, if you ever want to use my paintings on one of your records, go ahead. And I was like, wow. And so if any of you do know my discography, I think I have 10 recordings with Oliver Jackson paintings. And so that was always just amazing to me. And you, every time I call, say, Oliver, and you were so supportive of the music, and you said, yeah, man, go ahead and use this. And then we had, I was playing, I'll tell the story quick, how we did our big work together. I was playing at the Guggenheim Museum. Now, that may sound like, it wasn't like last night. It was very funny because the Guggenheim's very reverberant. They would put a band there also on their free night where you would get your tickets, but they were like really on our case. You're too loud. What you're playing is too crazy. And, you know, it sort of turned out that they sort of just want us to play Girl from Ipanema. But anyway, I finish, and this gentleman walks up to me and says, hello, I'm Harry Cooper. I've just been hired by Harvard University. I love your music. I think Oliver Jackson's one of the greatest painters in our country. And how would you like to come to Harvard and do a collaboration? And I was like, wow. How often does this happen in life? So we really thank Harry. And we did. He brought Oliver and I up there. We were there for 10 weeks together. We found this abandoned warehouse. Oliver's a genius with making things work. He had a painting studio. I think you saw some pictures. And we built a collaboration together called The Long View or The Place. We gave it different titles. But it then, these six large works of Oliver that he painted there were in the gallery, and this recording I did with 22 musicians called The Long View played sort of on a loop.
You were hearing that as you were coming.
And this is all because of Harry. So
I didn't know what I was getting into.
And he didn't know what he was getting into. We added a few gray hairs somewhere. But to move up to today, being here today really feels an extension of what we did 20 years ago.
Let me add one thing. Julius introduced me to
you. Yeah, Julius was the
right, because you got to meet this guy. And so we did, and we talked. And that's the way it was happening then. You meet someone, and you introduce them. You're fascinated what they're doing. I remember Lake when he was staying. You remember, where was it? Where he was staying, I met you, and they were playing in this cafe. You remember? And you guys were together. You and I used to have conversations about music and Coltrane and all that.
Yeah.
Before it all came together in bags, see, we knew each other and had been talking about things. It was a very exciting and interesting time. We were open, and it was, I think, the biggest thing, you're open and anxious to expand in some way. Really a lot of searching going on, don't you think? We're really trying to get a handle on who are we. You know, so that was exciting.
We were trying to find our voice, and we never stopped.
Well, how does working with this guy affect the way you play? I'm asking Oliver and Marty.
Oliver, do you want
Oliver.
Well, it's a continuum. It's part of what we do, and it's part of what artists have done prior to us coming on the scene. Again, it's about finding our voice and being original and never stopping and being open. And that's what he brings. Searching.
I think that says it beautifully. And one thing that Oliver Lee, but when we were collaborating, Oliver, you really talked a lot, because I always knew about Oliver's love for music deeply, and he paints to music all the time. But we were very careful that the work we were going to do was in no way going to be literal in the sense that this sound goes with that gesture. We worked very hard against that sort of obviousness. Does that make fair to say?
We talked about that.
Yeah, and we would talk about that at length. And we actually didn't do, I mean, I think once or twice I came over to your studio and I improvised some, yeah. But it really wasn't
the
point.
Well, you'd ask me to listen to it. You'd say, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
I go like, well, that's cool. It would be bits and pieces that he's putting together. And then I would go into your place. And we were separated. This is a large place he found us. A bit big. It was, remember, it was dilapidated, but we had the best rooms. And so if to get to his place,
it was all like,
there was
yeah.
a big
yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we're at Harvard University and we're in a rundown warehouse. Yeah.
So this was a warehouse in Somerville. I remember driving by and I saw the four.
It was a good place to work.
Sign.
It really was.
But it was perfect because it was big enough that you guys could both be on the same floor, but have separate spaces.
Right.
But they were communicating. They were joining.
It was a big hole, if you remember, yeah. that you had to avoid to get to this place.
Yeah.
It would fall.
I forgot about that.
Well, the other thing I remember is, not to spend the whole time on this, but you wanted to put, the floor wasn't so great, and, you know, you wanted to put down boards on the floor, you wanted a hammer, and I went home to my, almost like a dorm, and got you a hammer, and you looked at it, and you said, this is what you call a lady's hammer.
He did. He brought back the head and the hammer's about different. I said, man, I need a hammer. I mean, they're like.
So, this was my curatorial training.
Yeah. You know, one thing I learned about collaboration with Oliver, though, I wasn't aware that he painted on the floor, which he does. I also see he would put six coats of base. And one day I said, that doesn't look hard to do. You want me to help? He said, no. It's actually really specific. But then he starts to paint on the floor, and I would go and I just stand this one place, and what he was doing made no sense to me. And I got to admit, Oliver, I got worried.
I was worried too. You said
maybe he's lost it.
I was worried the whole time because it took a long time for anything to start happening.
Well, hang on a second. He's doing this painting, and I just can't figure it out. And Harry walks in one day and goes, okay, where's the bottom of the painting? And I'd never thought about this because I'd sat in this chair. Which was not that, because it's on the floor. And that was like really far out. And of course, I went to that side, the painting made unbelievable sense.
Well, the thing is, most people are used to seeing the finished product.
The
making process. Unbelievable. It's very, very, most people have no idea. See, they're used to seeing the finished, as it should be. The making process is a lot of physicality. It's also, and that includes preparation, just like house painting. You got to put this many coats down. You got to prepare it properly. The thing has to be smooth, et cetera, et cetera. And just, you know, that's the way it is in making. It's a lot of carpentry and all those things that are not art, but skill. See, not art, whatever that is. And then the way you begin a painting is the way musicians begin. What I learned from them is, how do you open this space up? This is not for people like you. What's being seen in the gallery, that's the end product. How do you begin? First mark. I learned from musicians. Now, what I learned, see, people always want to, you can't paint music. They make music. I make visual images. I'm not painting no music because I'm listening to it. But how do you open the space? So two-dimensional areas, permits a lot. And the first mark is your intention. It doesn't have to be anything that's recognizable by anyone else because ain't nobody in there but me. But I have to know where it guides me. So I have to pay attention. I learned it from musicians. When I used to, before I knew them, I would go and listen to music in joints, wonderful joints. And I would listen to Charlie Parker and how, before people knew that they were playing, how they made these sounds. To take the house. They take it different ways. One time, Max Roach hit the thing, pow, and the house got quiet. It was like lowering it in a theater. I learned from Paul Carter Harrison how you take the house by just dimming the lights. Well, I have to learn that in the canvas. They don't teach that in school. What are your intentions? And then how then you set the first marks? You're making it. And that's what I learned. It's a different way, many ways. Lester Young took it like this. Monk will open it up. They're really taking the space. Well, I had to learn to do that. To every mark. And then how do you build? So that every mark is the bones of the work. They may be eliminated, but it's still, that's the making process. That is hidden. Only makers can know it. The reason I learned it from musicians is that I wasn't bound by any dictionary or theory. I could hear it, I watched the result. You can do exactly the same thing in taking the world, making the world, you have to take it. Hopefully for us, we don't play in for the audiences, you make it alone, there's a big difference. They get immediate response after they practice. I don't know, maybe 6 months later when somebody looks at it. There's a real separation between me and the work I did a year ago. It is not me. It's that. So, you know, what I'm saying is, what I learned in the collaborations, I would go and to his place, and he'd be working with these little dots and things, and he'd play something for me. He's in the making process. So I was privy to it. You may not remember, you were recording in New York, and Julius made me sit in, I never had an experience while they were recording, in the middle of the band to hear what they heard. When I was sitting out in the audience, it was coming to me as a piece of music. But when I said it, I began to understand what they hear. It's very different than what I was hearing as a listener. I mean, how sensitive to every sound, every, you know, in the center of the, it's amazing. I'm telling you, it's simply amazing. So I was learning a lot. The transference, the interference, the hearing it all. And I was had the opportunity. I just said, it's like they're making the music. I'm now not outside receiving it. I'm in the midst of the making. And it was disorienting. It was music in a different way. So what, for me, is so isolated in terms of relationship of work, finished, and the audience. In the collaboration, it's one of the unique times that there is almost an immediate response between making something and an audience. They get this all the time. They get responses, applause. That don't happen for me, except in when Harry puts it together and people say, I really like it, so you know.
You know. However, we're having a collaboration now that, you know, it's hard to know when one solo ends and the other player can jump in. But but I do think that I learned a lot watching the Harvard collaboration and how it was important to have the separation as well as the closeness. I think, you know, modern art really is based on the idea of different languages, and we're using different languages, and then very tricky how to bring those together. It doesn't always work. But in the end, though, I think, if I recall, you ended up with six paintings, and you ended up in a composition with six parts, six movements. And we even thought about, in the display, at one point, maybe having the lighting shift so that one painting was illuminated during each movement, and we decided against that because that would be too literal. One thing I wanted to ask Oliver Lake, while I was at Harvard, I remember that you came up, and I don't know if you remember this, but you did a duo with a law professor.
Yes, Patricia Williams. It was brought together by a famous actress. I'm not remembering her name right now, but she paired us together, and she, Patricia Williams did a lot of writings about law and social injustice, and I improvised with her and also included some of my poetry. And that collaboration we did that for about 3 years, on one of my most unusual collaborations.
It was memorable. It was in Sanders Theater, which is the hallowed and ancient theater space there where all the ceremonies happen. And there you both were, and I've never heard anything like it, because those genres, improvised music and legal writing, are quite different, but it worked.
Well, I've always envied painters because I cannot write a word with bird or train or any of you guys on the box. I cannot write a single word. I have to turn it off to write. And I've always envied painters because every painter I know, every single one of them, has the music on loud as they're working. They're in there dancing and dancing into the canvas. And, you know, I mean, I don't really look for it in the painting, but I do see it.
Well, for me, the studio space is a work space. And so it is a unique workspace. When you work for somebody else in a working space, it fits like in a factory, 10 to 12 people. But now this is a space just for you, and you have to make it compatible. I can turn the music on and turn it on loud, and once I start working, it prepares the space. That's all. But when I start working, I don't hear it anymore. It's gone.
You don't hear it?
But absolutely not. It's a strange thing. See, it's like the preparation of the room. It's like making the right ambiance so I feel comfortable to go to work. Many of the painters are like that. See, it's just like, here's this factory, you're going to make something. But it's personal. It's not making it for GM, which is impersonal, you know, every 10 people. So how do you get ready for this space? It's real intimate. So you put on different moods, too. I will tend to always... what I'm intending to make, you know, it's a feeling, a really strong feeling, so it's got to come out. Okay, the music will tend to be in that vein, the urgency that I put on. It's like preparing. But once I start making the marks, it's concentration. I don't like to talk about it like it sounds intelligent. It's not, it's just focus. You know, I don't know what I'm thinking in the way people think. People ask you, what do you think about it? I mean, please. I'm thinking about this. Well, what are you thinking about this? I've not, it don't work that way. You know, it's like, what do you think? It's like, I'm there. I'm not thinking about what I'm thinking about. I'm not logging myself. You know, it ain't about me. I'm serious. It's not about me. It takes me to do that, I guess. But it's like, I think I work 15 minutes to be 3 hours. It's not the same. People want to be intimate. It's not for them. They don't make nothing. If they make something, they'll understand it. But they, you know, it's like, why do you need to know that? I mean, it sounds good, but it doesn't make the painting good. You could focus. It's a strange thing. It's a thing that you have to become critically really clear. You can bring your best, and it's lousy. You can bring your best, it might be right. You got to get that right. You got to be able to see when you know you have brought your best that it doesn't account for anything if it doesn't work. So you have to get up out of yourself to do that. Because generally, if you bring your best, you expect the best to be out there, but doesn't work that way. You know. And I heard musicians say that. I've heard them say, that wasn't very good. They make a self-evaluation. The audience might be clapping. I've heard them say that. I went on tonight. Well, they have an expectation that's different. Am I making sense? Yeah. I mean, it's very much the same. You know,
that's very interesting, Harry. I mean, jazz is fundamental to modernism. Harry could talk about for hours. I mean, from World War I on, when Europe took the Harlem Hellfighters band to Europe and stayed in France, and all the jazz exodus to Europe, all the modernist painters ate it up, and they tried very hard to paint like jazz. Picasso famously said how he wanted his planes to be like jazz riffs, you know, and every single, even all the movements tried to get jazz, the jazz feeling, the immediacy, the improvisation, the spontaneity. That was considered fundamental modernism. But it was not, it's a different approach than the one you made.
Well, a lot of artists came to grief, you know, trying to paint jazz, I think. I think the ones who saw it much as you're saying, as a kind of a parallel world.
Well, for Europeans, it was exotica. That's the reason they missed the point.
Well, they didn't all miss the point. There was
No. I didn't say, but most of them did. Picasso didn't miss the point. Picasso is a painter. Yeah. He got it.
Mondrian didn't miss the point, and Stuart Davis didn't miss the point. But I yeah.
But anyway, they were. It's just that they were trying to paint jazz.
Yes,
you know, you were trying to make have the music make the environment.
Yes.
Marty, you were going to say.
I think it's interesting, just to widen the screen a little bit, in that musicians talk a lot about colors in when they describe their music. Yet one of the fundamental, in many ways, painting or the visual art and painting in particular, music, are totally different in that music has to be experienced through time. While though you look at a painting over time, it does present itself in a totality. And that's always fascinated me. It was a thing that I had to think a lot about when we did our collaboration, because I had no control over when someone walked into the gallery. Like, you know, if it's a 2-minute shape that's going over time in music, I had no control of them starting at the beginning like you would in a concert. So that posed some interesting aesthetic questions. And I don't think this means anything. I think people are equally moved by both, but it's important to think that music happens through time, and that's why you can't think of it so literally. There's many more deeper spiritual, philosophical connections.
One thing I wanted to ask Mr. Lake, we were saying earlier, you have done poetry, did some of your poetry last night, painting, collaborating with yourself in a way, so you've experienced several genres.
Well, I think I'm an example of the fact that BAG was a school not only for me, but for the students that were there as well. But it was definitely my school, and I was influenced by the poetry, I was influenced by the visual arts, and of course the music, and I've continued to involve all of those elements in my performances throughout the years. So it's an exploration for me, and BAG was my school, is my school.
Do you feel something, some gears shifting when you put down the horn and pick up a pencil?
Or? No gear shift. No, I have a phrase, put all my food on the same plate. It's all the same. So it's different levels of expression. But for me, it's the same thing about exploring and being creative.
When he talked about time in music, he was talking about mechanical time. Mm-hmm. It takes place. But in visual thing, there's always time, but it's psychological time. Mm-hmm. Every work visually makes the viewer have an internal time. Some are urgent, and the time is swift. And so just looking at them, all you got to do, you could feel it. That's psychological time. See, in music, that happens too. Inside the mechanical time, which is 15 minutes, there is the psychological time, which could be eons in the experience.
So that's exactly the same.
Yes. That's where the collaboration can really fit. Even though he's looping the music, if it creates the mode, it is timeless. It's placed you in a world. The work, visual work, must do exactly the same thing. The media is different, but the objective is to hold you in a particular reality that's cohesive and is harmonious. So our gut thing is to make sure that the media, they're different, do their work to do that. That's when the collaboration really can live.
Outstanding.
Yep. Thank you all very much. Obie Spellman, Marty Ehrlich, Jackson.
Now, it's just a real honor to be here with A.B. Spellman. Let's hear one of the greatest, greatest writers we have in the country.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.